No. We'll do it live! Fuck it!
Yeah, we're a pair here. Let's get this shit show going. We're already technically recording. Everybody, welcome to the show. I'm Mike Coughlin, and this is Matt Grady, and that's a lot of enthusiasm to begin a podcast. I don't know what's going to happen because I'm ceding all control to Matt because I want to be lazy and I've got a doggy trying to get on my lap.
No, I like this gimmick. One person knows what the show's about; the other person has no idea. It's different. Nobody's doing this.
Yeah, it'll be especially different now that I'm basically sober. So
yeah, how's that going?
It's been a good thing.
Good.
Even when I'm trying to drink, that's tough. I'm like forcing it. So
yeah. Well, one benefit is you'll save some money too. It's like when people quit smoking cigarettes. Like, wow, I have a lot more money now. It's like, yeah. Well, you're spending $10 a day on cigarettes.
I have no idea how anybody could afford to smoke. Yeah, when I saw cigarettes in Chicago someplace today, they're like $13 a pack.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're going to be – I mean, people could easily spend $1,000 a month on cigarettes.
It's crazy.
That's an addiction, people.
All right. So following up from last week, the show we did last week, there hasn't been a ton of news in the MMA world, which has been strange. The last 6 months have been – pretty wild with everything going on. So this has been kind of a more quiet news cycle from what I can tell anyway. But this week there is a UFC Fight Night show coming from Salt Lake City, Utah on Saturday night on FS1. We talked about this a little bit last week, but it's headlined by probably one of the lower name value main events of any UFC show in recent history anyway. We've got Yair Rodriguez versus Alex Caceres in the main event, and the co-main is Dennis Bermudez versus Hani Jason. Any thoughts on those two fights?
Yeah, it's funny because this show, I can't remember, South Dakota was kind of weakish, and there was that show back in May that was also really, like, really weak. But this is, look, it's Jair Rodriguez, and I'm pretty sure the UFC obviously has real big hopes for him as being their Mexican star. They're desperate for one. This show actually has three really good fights. The two fights you just mentioned and the main event of Fight Pass of Tetsuya Kawajiri versus Cub Swanson. But I do think it's kind of, I don't know, I guess it's a sign of the times that the first time you go to Salt Lake City, Utah, you headline with a black guy versus a Mexican. maybe they didn't totally understand their market, or maybe Utah's, I don't know. It's just...
Or that's all they had. I mean, they've been running all these great shows with, you know, deep, deep cards, and it's like eventually something has to give at some point. But, I mean, I think people know Caceres from, obviously, Tough, the Ultimate Fighter, but Yair Rodriguez, I mean... not a lot of people have heard of him or know him. It's like this show on a Saturday night, I just don't see a lot of people staying home for it. I could be wrong. The company is hot, you know.
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. You're not wrong at all. Nobody's watching.
You think this will be like a record low rating?
I don't know. I think that as a general rule, the UFC is bigger than it has been in the past, and Fox Sports 1 is bigger. I don't really know what else is happening this Saturday night sports-wise. I can't think of anything off the top.
The Olympics are starting up.
Oh, yeah, they're doomed. Oh, they're going to get crushed. I guess they will. I guess they're basically just hoping on somewhat of a counter-programming on the Olympics. But if it was the Winter Olympics, they'd be better off because Winter Olympics tend to skew a lot more female. But I don't know. There's going to be some dudes running and people swimming and shit. And everybody wants to see what's going to happen with the Olympics. This thing's just a shit show already with the Australians being robbed in the middle of a fire and all kinds of stuff. So this could be great.
I love the Summer Olympics. It's the only time you can see, like, the best mixed doubles badminton teams on the planet. Like, it, there's so many weird sports that you never get to see ever. And it's like, I'm gravitating. I'm like, wow, they're really good at ping pong.
There's a
whole event that's just trampolines. Dudes jumping around on trampolines. Like, it's awesome. I love the Summer Olympics.
I mean, there are so many weird sports like that where, like, some part of me, I understand that it's a popularity thing. Honestly, like, I'll watch dudes flip around on a trampoline. That sounds kind of neat. On the other hand, it's dudes jumping on a trampoline. Like, that's not gymnastics. Gymnastics to me is, like, about actual physical strength and everything, and you have to be able to do these things on the ground. That's why it's impressive. Like, most people can jump really high on a trampoline and twist.
Right.
But whatever, more power, whatever. It's the fucking Olympics. In the winter, they go skiing and shoot things at the same time.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, a lot of these sports exist simply so that one of the countries out there has something to win. Like, the, you know, skiing and shooting. That exists so Norway can win a medal every once in a while. Like, that's, right. You know, that's why it's there.
Spread the wealth a little bit. Yeah, I mean, there's 10 different events with, like, horses, like, jumping over shit.
The equestrian and the dressage, and that stuff just pisses me off because that's just a horse. I'm sorry, that's the horse winning it. I think that the only way, if you want to tell me who's really good at that, it should be everybody trains. Everybody trains, and then they get a randomly assigned horse, and then you have to be able to control the horse. That way, that would be different. Like, I would do the same thing with race cars and stuff. Like, I think that'd be way more interesting if, like, everybody showed up and they got a look at the draw, and you went, oh, crap, I got that guy's car. And then you'd see who's actually a good driver, and not just which team has the best mechanics, or, you know, in this case, the best horse breeding and training. And yeah, the horses are on autopilot. They're a fucking animal. They don't know what they're doing. This, they know they get kicked twice, they jump, and that's it.
Right. Actually, this brings me to another topic I was going to get to later. You think there will ever be, in our lifetime, MMA in the Olympics?
No. Not even close. Never. No, it'll never happen.
How come?
Logistically, there's only going to be so many more Olympics in our lifetime. Maybe, what, if we're lucky, 10?
Yeah, I'm hoping to make it to my mid-70s. That'd be good.
Baseball's just coming back in 2020. They plan these things so far out in advance. And I don't think the sport would work as an Olympic sport. I don't think boxing works as an Olympic sport, but to the degree it exists, it's totally different than professional prize fighting, and I don't think there's just going to be enough countries to compete, and I think it'd be just I don't think most people would want to watch it, because if you're Conor McGregor, you're not going to go to the fucking Olympics, and if you're not getting if you're not getting the big name guys, nobody wants to see it. Now, we might see jiu-jitsu someday. I could see a form of submission grappling emerging in the next 20 or 30 years, but I think MMA, it's not going to work. I don't even want to see it. I'd rather just watch pros do it, and I don't want the Olympics getting involved. And you mentioned the corruption going on involved. I mean, look what happened to Russia with Fyodor and all that, and guys running that stuff. It'll be like that times 1,000.
Right. I mean, you could argue that with every sport, though, right? I mean, any of them can be corrupt. But yeah, logistically, I mean, is it an amateur thing? Can pros do it? There'd be a lot to go through, but I mean, I would never say never, because who the hell knows what's going to be going on 30, 40 years from now. They were going to pull wrestling from the Olympics just a couple of years ago. Remember the whole outrage?
I mean, yeah. Look, if they were going to pull wrestling, they're not going to add something even more like wrestling. I mean, although I did just get this is a crazy update. I like how I get a text from Peach, and he says, "Do you know how to get a hold of Dr. Drew?" I don't know.
I saw that.
He just texted me this now, too.
Yeah, so, no, he said he was sending tweets out. I actually retweeted it from
I don't know. I wish I did know how to get a hold of him. I would call him up and give him crap for being kind of shady. So,
here's a fun fact. You know there's one UFC signed fighter competing in the Olympics this year?
Let me
That's a, this is a good one.
Is it a Russian wrestler?
Yes.
Yeah, the guy that's like really a top level heavyweight wrestler from Russia. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but it's like Bilyal Makov or Makov, something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's like a. Obviously, he's wrestling in the Olympics for Russia. Obviously, he's a pretty good wrestler. But he's won some world championships. He won bronze in 2012. And then he also, in the Worlds this year, bronzed in both freestyle and Greco-Roman.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is never – it's like hasn't happened in 40-something years.
That's what I remembered about him is that he was a dual wrestler, which is just scary as hell. I mean, that guy must just have – some natural freaky strength and balance, and they need somebody to heavyweight eventually, so why not a crazy scary Russian that worked in the past?
Yeah. He's 28. Obviously no idea when he would start fighting, but I presume he'd want to get training and start making some money here at some point. Although the Russians, I mean, they pay their athletes. I've heard that anyway. But, yeah, so that'll be interesting. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how the UFC promotes him, especially if he comes off, he wins a medal or something. They've got this debuting 0-0 fighter who just came off winning a silver whatever medal at the 2016 games. That could be a big deal. He's fighting at 125 kilograms, which that's a lot of pounds. That's like 276. Yeah, so you'd have to cut some weight to make heavyweight, obviously. But he's a big dude.
Yeah, I mean, hey, at heavyweight, if you have any kind of real skills, you're instantly a legitimate top level prospect. You know, if he weighed 150 pounds and was doing this, I would. Be a little more. I mean, I would still think, oh, that guy could be a prospect. But at heavyweight, you go, oh, that guy could be world champion in about a year.
Yeah, no, you would think, especially with the division the way it is, with every guy pushing 40. Anyway, we got sidetracked there big time. Originally, we were talking about the show this Saturday coming up. So yeah, I mean, the rest of that card, Bermudez, Jason. Talles Leites is fighting Chris Camozzi. Leites would obviously be the favorite in that fight. And then you look at the rest of that card, and it's legit. Some names that are familiar to me, and a few guys I've never even heard of. So it'll be interesting. I feel like a lot of times shows like this, where you don't expect much and you're not really that excited for it, ends up being the most action-packed shows. You're like, oh my god, did you see that show? It's like, no, I didn't even know there was a show. So it could be one of those where it's a bunch of good fights.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the top two fights, I mean, the main event, Yair Rodriguez and Alex Caceres, the way they match up, that matches up is just an outstanding fight. Neither guy's a real strong wrestler on the ground. They're both very aggressive, and they go for it. And on the feet, they are, you know, very aggressive and dynamic in their striking. So I expect the main event to be very good. Again, I think that they're hoping Yair wins. I would favor him. I think he's a natural featherweight, whereas Bruce Leroy has bounced between 35 and 45. And then again, Dennis Bermudez. I mean, Bermudez almost always has exciting fights. Hani Jason always has exciting fights. And, you know, I mean, Talles Leites, I'm a big fan of his. I'm a bit of a mark for him. Chris Camozzi, I am stunned that he's still in the company. I don't know why he's still around. Just weird.
I think he picked up that short notice fight, the first one with
Jacare.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it takes some. He was out of the company at the time, and he picked it up short notice. And it's like that takes some balls. You kind of got to respect that to get back into the company of all the guys in the world to have to fight short notice. Jacare would not be my first choice. So I think he's still living off some of that. But he is, believe it or not, he's got three straight wins right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's
again,
winning.
I mean, it's not huge names. You got Tom Watson, Joe Riggs, and Vitor Miranda. He's not beaten highly ranked guys by any stretch. But since the second Jacare fight, he's won three in a row. So he's probably not even going anywhere anytime soon, even if he gets starched in this fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's Laetus's fight to lose, pretty much. If Laetus wins, he should win. It'll just kind of reestablish him a little, but again, neither guy's really going anywhere soon. The rest of the card on the main card, Santiago Ponce Nibio, he just came off of beating the shit out of Court McGee, which was kind of impressive. And he's from Argentina, which is, you don't see too many guys like that. But I don't know. I don't like Zach Cummings. Again, I don't know why. You know, he's only been in the company for like 2 years, but I feel like he's been around forever, but it may just be because he looks like every other dude there is. And then you got Marina Morose and Danielle Taylor coming in on short notice. Morose is, you know, she's kind of a prospect. People kind of like her. She's got a bit of a look. She's got enough of a name. Danielle Taylor is so unknown that she has, I think, like 300 followers on Twitter, I just checked. So, I mean, like, when, like, the half-guarded website, you know, we almost have, like, seven times as many followers as she does. So, like, or six times, five times, whatever. More than five times as many followers. Like, we're a bigger deal. More people know us than they know her. So, yeah, she'll probably lose. But, hell, when it comes to the women, it's such a crapshoot. You know, if you're not, like, one of the top-level females, there's just such a drop-off, and it could so easily be any of them.
Right. I mean, the rest of the card, the prelims, I mean, Court McGee's really, Dominique Steele are really the only names on that undercard besides the Swanson Coward Jerry fight, which is actually on Fight Pass. That, like, to me, that should be on the main card. I mean, Cub Swanson's still like a top five featherweight. I think Coward Jerry's even ranked in the top 15 now. So to me, it's like, I get they want to build Fight Pass, but nobody's going to buy a subscription to Fight Pass for that fight. So to me, it's kind of a waste.
I kind of agree. Like, I know why they're doing it. They are making, and to their credit, they're making a very concerted effort to put quality fights on Fight Pass. Since I get Fight Pass and I don't have any money invested in the company, I don't give a shit. But it, and maybe in the long run, stuff like this isn't the worst thing to do, because if you spread out really good action fights throughout the card, maybe that just makes for a more enjoyable experience overall, as opposed to sometimes when you're watching it, it's like, okay, this is going to be 6 hours of my life and only the last hour and a half is entertaining. You're kind of like, I know, like, there's been times when I'll be mentally drained by the time a great fight's happened. I'm almost like, I just don't care now. But if, you know, space it out, build it out like a card, I don't know. I mean, whatever. I get to see the fights either way. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the mindset is they're trying to build Fight Pass. Like, I totally get that. But at the same time, Swanson Coward Jerry's not going to draw anybody to Fight Pass. But on the main card, like, having one of those guys with an exciting win could build him for another fight. If Cub Swanson knocks out Coward Jerry in the first round, nobody's going to see it. If it's somebody with more of a name, like you're doing Bisping Anderson Silva on Fight Pass, people are going to buy Fight Pass just for that fight. I don't. There's a happy medium, I think. And in this case, I think they missed the boat. But
yeah, I think actually Talos Leitas and Chris Camozzi would have been a better fight to main event Fight Pass, in that it's not going to really make a difference on TV. Hardcore fans, though, that get Fight Pass would see that as a fight where they go, you know what, that's a name fight with two guys that are, you know, decent fighters. It wouldn't feel like you're watching just no name scrubs or anything like that.
Yeah, even Court McGee would have been okay. Because he's, I mean, granted, he's not a high ranked fighter and he doesn't have the most exciting fights, but he's a name people know just coming off the Ultimate Fighter. I mean, people were still kind of watching it back then.
I suspect that guys like Court McGee are almost always going to be on TV with, especially Fox Sports 1. Just because they're in the Ultimate Fighter, and I'm not that there's an explicit agreement, but I think Fox Sports probably kind of expects them to be on TV.
Yeah, that makes sense too. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. All right, so that's your fight night preview for this Saturday, August 6th. Changing gears here. We've got Mark Hunt in the news again. I know we beat it to death last week. But here is a quote from him on Twitter from Monday. I don't know if you saw this, but he wrote, "Don't fucking waste my time with your bullshit testing, okay? Why are you even testing when you fuckers don't know shit about it? Take your out-of-competition testing and stick it up your ass. Cheating motherfuckers. What a bunch of wankers."
So, Mark Hunt, for those that don't know, has a PhD in biochemistry. He's very knowledgeable about all these things. He's not spent the past 20 years of his life making a reputation for just getting punched in the head a lot. Oh, wait, no. He did do that, and he doesn't know anything about how drug testing works. I understand being frustrated, and, I mean, good gosh, Brock. I mean, he looked juiced to the gills, and Hunt is, I mean, really, at the age of 40, took some shots there. I don't know exactly what he's doing here, other than probably...
So, I mean,
I think he's getting liquored up and just going off on people.
He could be. I wonder how many... I wonder what his tolerance is like compared to yours. He must need a lot of booze to get a buzz. But here's the thing. I mean, to me, I mean, I don't know if he's gone on record any more than that tweet. I haven't seen anything otherwise. But it sounds like USADA, whatever, came to collect a sample, and he booted him and refused to take the test. So it'll be interesting how that pans out. Granted, he's been asking either for Brock's half of Brock's purse, all of Brock's purse, or a release anyways. So clearly he's not happy and trying to make some noise, and maybe he does want out. Maybe he'd rather go fight in Ryzen twice a year and possibly make the same, if not more, money. I don't know what his true motive is here. That tweet was something else.
Let me say, if you're concerned about fighting guys on drugs, Ryzen is the place to go.
Right. No kidding. I mean, that's the thing that's weird about the whole Hunt story here, is that he fought. Like, I get his complaint and his gripe. He's reportedly going into the cage clean, and he's fought three guys, literally got into the cage and fought three guys who later failed tests that night. Like, they took a piss test that night, the results came back a couple weeks later, and it happened with Bigfoot Silva, happened with Frank Mir, now it's happened with Brock. And it's like, to a degree, it doesn't make sense. But again, only a few years ago, all they had was fight night testing. That's all they had. That's all that existed. There was no out of competition testing at all. That was only a couple years ago. So it's a weird thing. He has a right to be upset, but at the same time, the testing and the punishments are a lot better now than they were a few years ago. And light years ahead, there was no testing in Pride, where he fought for years. So it's weird. Some of it kind of sounds like sour grapes, but at the same time, he does have a point. I've kind of got mixed feelings on it, but
I mean, realistically, there's nothing they can do. It's just going to take time for the tests to come back, and
right.
It's really weird to think that a cage fighting organization has by far the most, it seems most demanding and strict drug testing program in at least the United States, the entire world. I mean, Russia literally, burrowed holes in the wall during the last Olympics and to help their guys cheat. And, the NFL, those guys all know when the tests are coming. And meanwhile, the UFC is suspending the biggest guys they've got. I mean, they took the guy responsible for the biggest buy rate in the history of the sport, and he's suspended for 2 years. They took their other big draw. He's suspended 2 years. And this is a time when they could use some more draws, and they're just saying, fuck it. Nobody's safe. From Chad Mendes, BJ Penn, John Jones, and Brock Lesnar, that's like the equivalent of going out there and suspending Tom Brady and, not Jay Cutler, because nobody would care. Nobody would have suspended Tom Brady 2 weeks before the Super Bowl. They thought he was cheating using the inflated footballs, which he probably was, New England. But
in the, he probably was.
He still played in the Super Bowl, and he still played the entire next season, and now he's like finally being suspended for 4 games. Are you kidding me? That's like the equivalent of Brock failing a steroid test, getting the fight still at UFC 200. No, it'd be like if John Jones still got to fight at UFC 200, and then got to fight at Madison Square Garden, then fought again next January, and then next June, and then finally they said, okay, now you're going to be suspended, and it's only going to be for, you know, the equivalent of 9 months.
Right.
Oh, well, whatever. Not my life.
No. All right, another big story. I mean, I wouldn't say big, but it's gotten a little press. These rules changes coming out. Basically, I forget what it is, the ABC, the Association of Boxing Commissions, or whatever ABC stands for.
Yeah.
I should know that, but I don't.
That's what it stands for, yeah.
Okay, good. So there were a few changes. Maybe you can give me your thoughts on each of them. They were talking about being more liberal with 10-8 rounds, looking for judges to look for dominance, duration, and impact slash damage. If a round has two of these characteristics, a 10-8 should be considered. Obviously, just in the last couple months, there's been a lot more 10-8s, but they've been used very erratically. And I mean, to me, that's a little bit of a concern because, again, it's a subjective thing. How do you define what a 10-8 is? Do you need, in boxing, you need a knockdown for a 10-8. In MMA, that sort of strict guideline that still doesn't exist, even with this rule change.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's always been clamoring for more 10-8s, more 10-7s, which, first of all, get rid of 10. Nobody's ever going to get to 5. A guy will die. You'd have to kill somebody. Because either somebody would die or there'd be so many fouls committed in a round that the referee would disqualify someone. So get rid of the entire 10-point system. Go to basically a 3-point system. Winner gets 3, loser gets 2, 1, or 0. It's going to be the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, increasing the liberal usage of the scoring is good. Everybody wants to see it. Personally, and I saw here in Chicago, we had a lot of weird scores. Like, felt like there were more 10-8s than usual. My problem is that I am less concerned about what type of system they're using than who's doing the judging. I want qualified judges and I want consistency. If everything's, sure. If it's all going to be 10-9, unless somebody almost dies and then they get a 10-8, so be it. I think that from an athlete's perspective, consistency matters way more than how they're going to liberally judge it, because you want to know when you go into a fight, what do I have to do? And if you go in there and you know that every round's going to be just 10-9, then that's it. Nothing will ever be a 10-8. So be it. At least you know what the rules are in advance. But when we keep changing the standards and, you know, are all the judges going to be on board? Are they all going to be paying attention? So many of these judges are so entrenched in their way of doing things that you could tell them, well, you should be scoring more 10-8s. But clearly they must watch MMA outside of when they're scoring. They've heard this before. This wouldn't be new. So, I mean, yeah, it's good, but I'd rather see them spend $1 million on a comprehensive program to re-educate all judges from the ground up, have guys go through real training. If I was a UFC, I mean, I wrote years ago about how that you should just get rid of, the UFC should just ignore athletic commission judges, hire their own judges, and basically have the same set of judges for basically each weight class. Cause I think that even then, how do you, heavyweights versus flyweights, it's a totally different fight. And you have to be have a totally different mindset as a judge, because, you know, heavyweights generally don't have as much action, obviously, as flyweights. So to judge them the same doesn't make any sense. You know, I think the whole thing needs to be redone, but it never will be. It's like any bureaucracy in the corporate world, the government world, the more entrenched it gets, the more it's just going to stay like that. And maybe this is the best we get.
I mean, well, the one thing, I mean, from my memory, is that this is the first really major, and these aren't major changes. They're tweaks here and there, but this is the first set of tweaks since 01, as far as I can remember, unless I'm missing something. I mean, when New Jersey came out with the unified MMA rules back in 2001, there hasn't been much change at all that I can recall.
It'll be really easy to tell if it works or not, because when a change happens and it's good, it gets adopted immediately. Like, we just saw this in the past year. California went to the early weigh-in, and now everyone in the country does the early weigh-in, and that's now standard practice. And
that's true.
Because everybody liked it. So if the rule changes make sense, they'll probably be adopted and they'll be implemented right away. If they're difficult or confusing, they just won't be.
Yeah, it's funny too, because so much of it's going to be political too. I mean, it took the UFC almost 20 years to get back into New York State. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It depends on what the motives are and who the people involved are. That'll impact it a lot. So we've got more liberal use of 10-8. They also changed the definition of a grounded fighter. Basically that 3-point stance rule where, guys would be standing but kind of like bent over, put a hand down, and they couldn't be struck in the head. They changed that basically to be grounded now. Both hands and feet, and or any other body part must be touching the floor. At that time, no kicks or knees to the head will be allowed. It was weird because New Jersey, I think, was the state that voted against a lot of these. Basically, all the states vote on these new rules. And I think New Jersey was the state that had an issue with this because they were looking at it like it could lead to more head trauma, which maybe it could. But the problem with that rule in the past was guys would intentionally kind of tease their hand being on the ground, and they could use it to stall or try and get a disqualification point for themselves by sneaking the hand down right before a strike was thrown towards the head. You think this is a step in the right direction or a step backwards?
It's weird. On the one hand, I'm glad to see anything that does away with the guys who are gaming the system, and everybody's seen it when a guy is just putting his hand down, bringing it up, putting his hand down, bringing it up. And we've kind of seen a lot of the referees be very clear that, hey, you keep doing this, I'm not going to call that as a foul. I know a game you're playing. And the goal from these guys with the new rule was, we want to just kind of create more of a bright line. Just get rid of the gray area. If your hand's down, you got to have more than just one hand down. It'll change things from a technical perspective for sure. A lot of the way the guys wall walk and get up to their feet is going to change now, because you're going to lose that safety valve of being able to keep your hand down as you get up. It would be difficult, but I would almost want to have like a more active and involved referee. Like in Japan, they used to have the referees yell out catch when the guy was close to a submission to alert the judges that a submission hold was nearby for judging purposes. Which is kind of weird, but they did it. I would almost like to see it where once you are up, you cannot down yourself. And once, you know, a guy was up, the referee would say, he's up, and then it's all fair game. So if you're on the ground and you're trying to get up, your opponent has to watch what they're doing, mind their P's and Q's, and not go crazy. But once a referee makes a determination that you're up, then the opponent and everybody involved knows, okay, it's go time. I get so annoyed with the guys putting their hands down, and I think that this probably won't be a big deal. I think that we've seen this foul happen, and it's actually kind of a fairly consistent foul. And it's just so unintentional, and I think it's so difficult for guys to really see. I mean, a guy is hanging his hand down. Is it on the ground? Is it not on the ground? Well, again, uniformity matters to me more than anything. Making things clear, making things consistent. New Jersey did not vote to approve this. That said, I'm pretty sure that they will.
Yeah, it was like 42-1.
Yeah, yeah.
New Jersey was the one state, and then you've got the other states that don't have commissions or just didn't show up for this.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand not wanting to increase brain damage. At the same time, like, it's cage fighting. There's no way around the fact that these guys are
hit in the head.
The point of the sport is to cause brain damage. It's not like football where, you know, in football people get brain damage, but it is in theory incidental to what they're doing. You can in theory win a football game without hurting someone. You don't really win a fight without hurting somebody, or at least putting them in a position where they have to tap or else they're gonna get hurt.
Right. You could probably answer this better than me, but I was just thinking from a technical standpoint, say you've got, you know, the 3-point stance, you've got 2 feet down, your hand down. What's to stop you from doing the same thing now with your other hand? Teasing it, you know?
If you have both hands down,
yeah,
you're gonna lose the ability to stand up. It's gonna be a lot more difficult. You always said that. Usually what happens is guys get the half guard, then they get that underhook, and they use the underhook to stand up. If you don't have that underhook, your opponent will then just get the underhook, and he can use that to control your body a lot more. That underhook is all of grappling. If I ever write a book, it's going to be called Grab the Underhook, Asshole. Like, it's like the most basic thing. It is how you control your opponent. If you're on the bottom, if you're on top, you know, you see, if a guy, especially from half guard, and that's how guys wall walk, that's how they get up, guys will get an underhook, then they kind of wall walk or they turtle up to their knees, and then they stand. If you don't have that underhook, it's going to be a lot easier for the guy to jump and take your back, a lot easier for him to just drag you down, because that underhook prevents the guy from getting around and taking your back. So guys really won't be able to just put both hands down without exposing their back and really, really exposing their back. I mean, like, when you practice jumping on someone to take their back, if they put both hands and both feet on the ground like that, that's like the easiest way in the world to take their back.
Right. Another one. Female clothing is the title of this one. Something you'd never think you'd talk about on a cage fighting podcast, but I guess the issue was loose fitting, like t-shirts. Now they must wear a short sleeved above the elbow or sleeveless form fitting rash guard and or sports bra. No more, you know, tank tops or t-shirts or anything loose fitting, I guess. Seems kind of inconsequential, but I don't know. Am I missing something?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. You don't see a lot of women wearing loose clothing anyways, but to the extent that someone is, it makes sense. It'll prevent toes from... It's pretty much just going to prevent toes from getting caught in clothes on kicks and things like that. But women... When it comes to the women and the clothing, we've seen, you know, Valerie Letourneau had that, you know, an accident.
Those season. Kicks. Yeah.
And some of the women were blaming Reebok, and I don't know how much of that's true. But I've always thought it's kind of one of the advantages that women would have over men is that they could wear essentially a rash guard. And if you're a grappler, all that friction is going to be a gigantic difference in life. Like, that'll really help you. But I think this is just a tiny little minor tweak of a rule. And I think nobody will even notice it takes place.
Right. Absolutely. Two more. They remove two fouls, heel strikes to the kidneys, and probably one of the weirder ones, and you might need to explain this one to me, grabbing of the clavicle. Heel strikes to the kidneys, I get that. That's like an old, like, Hoist Gracie move. I can remember him throwing those when he was basically in full guard, he would go for those heel strikes to the kidneys. And I mean, obviously that would be annoying, but it was one of those things that was banned, I think, in probably 2001 when they started with the unified rules, kind of like the 12 to 6 elbow thing. Did you see anything there as far as the heel strikes?
It's kind of, I mean, the problem with
it seems like a dirty move. But I mean, that might just be from watching the sport the last 15 years as it's been.
Yeah, I'm agnostic on them. If they're in, fine. If they're not in, so be it. It doesn't matter to me either way. I can make an argument against them in the sense that they will not damage somebody in the fight. They're an annoyance. They're kind of like just palm striking. Like if you're on the bottom and just kind of slapping somebody's head, you're just kind of moving the guy, but that is legitimate. There is something to be said for moving a guy and making him uncomfortable. The difference between that and like the kidney strikes is that you may not really feel or get substantially injured during the fight because of the kidney strikes, but the next day you could be pissing blood. I don't care about the long-term health effects from that. That's what New Jersey was saying. Oh, in the long run, this could cause problems. Again, everything these guys are doing is going to cause problems in the long run. But yeah. I'm not a fan of techniques that don't hurt you now, but tomorrow you could be injured. I feel like if you're going to hurt somebody, it has to hurt them during the fight. Like, this is not, you know, we're not doing leg kicks and hoping that it affects them 3 days from now. We want it to affect them 3 minutes from now, and those kidney strikes don't really do it. That said, nobody really does them as a technique. And frankly, if you're on the bottom, a lot of guys who are comfortable off their back aren't going to – they're going to be throwing up triangles and submissions anyways, and guys that aren't comfortable aren't going to risk doing that because it's just opening up their guard and making it easier for someone to pass. So,
I mean, that was my other question. Like, if you're on the bottom, what's the benefit of throwing those? You're just going to annoy the other guy and make him want to pass more, right?
It would probably force guys to maybe posture up a little bit or move out of position. And sometimes when you're on the bottom, if you can get a guy just to move, a fraction of an inch off of where he wants to be, arm bars and all that, you know, it's all about the center line and, you know, drawing a line straight down the center of your body. And if you can get the guy to one side or the other just for a little bit, maybe that helps set up an arm bar a little bit better. I could see that where I could like be heel kicking somebody in the kidneys and then instantly putting my foot on their hips to elevate myself up for an arm bar or a triangle. But I don't think that in the long run this is going to change anything, and I don't think you're going to see fights fought in a different way because of it.
All right, and what's the deal with grabbing the clavicle? I've never grabbed someone's clavicle in my life.
Did they make it illegal?
It was a foul.
Okay,
now
okay.
It's no longer a foul. Yeah. It's legal. You can do that. Why would you want to?
I don't really know. I guess.
No, that makes me feel better.
Well, I would.
I don't know either.
I would think that it's probably because a clavicle is similar to like a small joint manipulation, and that you could probably break it easier. But I still don't think you're allowed to do what they call, you know, you can do a variation of the rape choke, but you can't squeeze the Adam's apple still, I think. I think that's still prohibited.
The only two, basically they removed two fouls. It was the heel strike to the kidney and the grabbing of the clavicle.
And I don't think I've ever even heard of anybody being fouled for grabbing the clavicle. So,
the 12 to 6 elbow rule would have been more a bigger one to remove, because at least, you know, I mean, the classic instance is John Jones and Matt Hamill. John Jones has one loss on his record because he lost by DQ for throwing downward elbows. If you were going to change one foul, that would have been the one to change.
These
other ones are
kind of
inconsequential.
Yeah, to me, the clavicle one, it's kind of like going through the books in your state and seeing that you're not allowed to ride your horse on Sundays, being like, well, we have this really dumb law, let's just get rid of it. I don't know who came up with it. It's probably some guy that wanted to be able to say and tell his grandkids, hey, I made a difference and changed something in the world of MMA once, but whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, the most interesting part of this is probably the most boring part of it for most people if they're not bored already.
They are.
Because here's the thing. What's the deal? Not every state has to adopt these rules because each state has its own commission for the most part, except, you know, like Wyoming, a state that has no commission at all. So, I mean, you presume most states will adopt these, but some states take longer. They gotta be, passed by a legislature. They can't be done immediately. So it'll be interesting to see if the rules are going to differ from one state to the next. Again, these are minor changes. They're not huge, but it'll be interesting to see how they roll out across the country because every state's got its own set of baggage and rules and laws. So, I mean, to me, that'll be kind of interesting to see how it goes down.
Yeah. The rules are the rules in the sense of it's up to the athletic commissions. I mean, minor things like this, I would imagine almost every athletic commission has the built-in authority to make those changes. But again, they may not. You know, California, a lot of their stuff has to go through committee in order to become law, and they tend to pass it. They don't fight these guys on it. But, you know, we've also seen instances in the past where states will just ignore the rules if the UFC is coming to town. Columbus, Ohio, for a long time, they had rules about your mandatory same-day weigh-ins, and then when the UFC wanted to come to town, they didn't have to do it. Yeah, you know, whatever the UFC decides is going to be the rules is going to be the rule. But again, look at the rules. Nobody's calling heel strikes to the kidneys. Nobody's calling clavicle grabbing. And the downed opponent one, I think that they're all just going to just let it go. I think that the referees will all say, well, these are the unified rules, and the UFC would say we operate under the unified rules, and while technically the referees are employees of the state, or agents of the state, I should say, for the purposes of an event, in all reality, they probably want to be consistent as well, and unless some, athletic commission specifically says, do not allow that to happen, I bet most of them won't even know what's going on. I bet you the athletic commission in Utah doesn't have a fucking clue what's going on.
Yeah, most likely. I mean, the other one is Jersey. I mean, New Jersey saying they're not going to adopt the grounded fighter definition, and they're not going to remove heel kicks to the kidneys, which obviously they've got. They take precedence over the boxing commission. I mean, the boxing commission can't override what the state athletic commission wants to do. So again, I mean, granted it's one state and maybe they'll come around and just say, you know what, screw it, we'll match everybody else. But for now, they're not on board with those two. So
yeah, it's interesting because for a long time, New Jersey had a lot of power, but now that they're trying to, you know, do something, and to their credit, I think they come from this from a very genuine perspective. This doesn't strike me as them saying, you know, just trying to exercise power for the sake of exercising power. I mean, their opposition essentially comes down to them publicly saying, well, you're just creating things that could, in theory, hurt somebody more. Yeah, hitting the kidneys from the bottom, that does increase the chance of somebody getting hurt more. Same with, you know, grabbing a clavicle. That, in theory, could lead to more injuries and so on and so forth. The problem is that New Jersey's importance is gone because...
What's New York? Yeah.
Exactly. Like, they used to run Jersey because they couldn't go to New York, but now that you can go to Madison Square Garden and the Barclays Center and all these places, New Jersey is going to become a distant, distant, distant memory, I think.
Yeah. Let's move on to something else now. Coming off his win at UFC 201, Tyron Woodley, new welterweight champ, is making a little bit of noise for himself here, which is good because he's probably got some of the lowest name recognition of any welterweight champ ever. Basically, right after the show, he was talking with Stephen Thompson. Thompson was at the desk asking Woodley questions, and essentially Woodley turned down Thompson, who is the number one contender and probably deserves a title shot more than anybody else in the division. And he encouraged Thompson to take another fight first against Robbie Lawler, the guy he just beat. And instead, Woodley is saying he wants a big money fight, and he's looking to fight Nick Diaz or GSP. Diaz is being Diaz, and GSP has claimed he's down for a fight with Woodley. What do you see happening here? You see Thompson getting the next shot, or Diaz, or GSP? How do you see this one panning out?
I mean, obviously, GSP would be the dream for him. Nick Diaz would be a nice consolation prize, I guess. I don't know if GSP is coming back. He always talks a lot, but I'll believe it. At this point, I'll believe it when I see it. I think that probably, I mean, Wonderboy would be, he's done really well, but some part of me is like, yeah, his big win, you know, he beat Ellenberger and he beat, you know, Johnny Hendricks, but now it looks like beating Johnny Hendricks wasn't nearly as big a deal as it seemed at the time. I think that
he's got the Rory McDonald win too. I mean, he's coming off that fight. Granted, it wasn't a dominant performance or anything.
That's true.
Mean, he won that fight.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a great case. I would think that I think that probably the best opponent from both earning it and name recognition would be the winner of Carlos Condit and Damian Maya.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just so intrigued at the idea of Damian Maya getting in there and fighting somebody for a world title just to see if he can keep doing what he's been doing here. And obviously Condit is awesome, and him and Woodley have unfinished business as well. So, you know, there's three guys there. From a, you know, just a personal perspective, they're all interesting. They all present different questions. And that's what's really neat about it, is that you have three guys who are totally different from each other that could face Woodley. Obviously, yes, if GSP comes back, he'll get the fight. Everybody would be happy. I don't see that happening. I don't see George St. Pierre coming back to fight Tyrone Woodley. It just...
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because I almost feel like GSP's looking for a fight he feels confident he can win. And you hate to say that because the guy was so great for so long. But it's like, we all know full well he wanted that McGregor fight. Like, he hadn't been around in years, and then he shows up at that show. I mean, come on. He wanted that McGregor fight. Then he was even talking about fighting Nate Diaz, like two smaller guys that he could probably bully and take down for, you know, five straight rounds if he had to. And now he's saying he wants Woodley. So to me, to a certain degree, he's starting to be the boy who cried wolf a little bit. He's talking McGregor, he's talking Nate Diaz, he's talking Woodley. He's talking about going up to 185 and fighting Bisping. The next week he's saying he could make it to 155. So I don't know. I mean, either do it or don't at this point for me. I'm just kind of getting tired of hearing about it. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. I mean, obviously Woodley would probably like to be on that, MSG show coming up in November. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. You know, from a money perspective, GSP is the most money. Although from a risk reward perspective, I think Nick Diaz is the best opponent. Woodley's got a style that can beat Diaz, and it would be a lot of money still. That said, there's no way in hell you can justify Nick Diaz fighting for the title. It's not like he's that big of a star where you can just give him whatever he wants. He's a big star. He'll make a lot of money. He'll drum up a lot of interest. But honestly, I'd rather see, you know, Nick and George St. Pierre fight again or something like that. Nick's got to do, he's got to get a win, but, you know.
It's been a long time since he's won a fight. It's been a long time. His last three fights, he lost.
Yeah.
I mean, there was Condit, GSP, it's off the top of my head, and Anderson, I think, were the last three.
Yeah.
And he's been suspended for years in between those fights. So it's like, he hasn't won in 4 or 5 years, I don't think.
He's in a weird position because I think that he and his brother, after Nate beat Connor, it's like they realized we got something. Like, it's like they suddenly realized that they're a draw and that people would pay to see them, and they're aware of it. And I love Nate talking about how, like, if I beat McGregor, I'm going to shake all this stuff up. It's like I think they're finally, like, they've matured. We've watched them grow from complete morons to complete morons who understand how to sell being morons.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, too, because Diaz, Nick, we should call them by their first names now. A couple of years ago, people would just assume you were talking about Nick, but, Nick Diaz did a couple interviews because his suspension just ended. And a couple things I took away from these was he's still crying about the GSP loss. he made a couple ridiculous claims. And I think you even wrote a quick article on halfguarded.com about this, that he claims he was drugged before the fight. Like, this is like... Like, that's getting to some Dada 5000 stuff. Like, Dada 5000 was claiming somebody, like, put something in his water, and that explained his poor performance against Kimbo. So he claimed that he was drugged before the fight, that GSP didn't make weight, which I remember being an issue for them, his camp at the time, and that GSP wasn't drug tested. He said something that... He had to piss in a, like, camera film, like a roll of film case. Remember those little cases?
Yeah.
Like, that's a weird reference he even made. Like, those don't even exist anymore as far as I know. I mean, what the hell? And then they put scotch tape over it, and that was the drug testing for the fight. So basically, he claimed GSP was on steroids, GSP didn't make weight, and that someone roofied him before the fight. Like, he's amazing.
He's awesome. Back. He's back. That's what it is.
He's back. But it's like, does he genuinely, because he seems like he genuinely believes it. It's not like a Chael Sonnen thing. Like, that sounds like shit Chael Sonnen would say just to make headlines. Like, I feel like Nick Diaz genuinely believes the stuff he's saying.
Oh, for sure. And it's interesting because, I mean, the drug testing thing, I have no idea. That sounds to me like Nick's kind of exaggerating, or maybe just, you know, the testing kit looked different than he's used to. But there was something funky about the weigh-ins. I don't think that it mattered. I don't think there was, like, they changed at the last second to give George St. Pierre the little advantage.
Or, you know, GSP would have cut the extra pound.
Exactly.
I mean, he's never not made weight in his career.
But it's, like, but it still happened, which is weird. Right. And, as far, obviously he was not drugged beforehand. My guess is, he had an off night, and he said, you know, I was in the best shape. I was in the best shape ever, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't fight like it. It sounds to me like the guy overtrained for the first time and didn't, you know, had never done that.
Or he was fighting GSP, the greatest welterweight of all time.
There is also
the
fact.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, no, I mean, granted, GSP, people forget, but GSP is arguably, especially now, maybe the greatest fighter of all time. If you look at John Jones with the PEDs, granted, I don't know what GSP is doing, obviously, but he hasn't been popped for anything ever in his career. So Jones has been popped. Fedor is just...
No.
The last couple years has looked like garbage. And in his prime, he was fighting guys who weren't even fighters. Sometimes. And then, I mean, the other argument's Anderson Silva. That was always, those two guys were peers, mm-hmm. one division apart. And Silva obviously had the more spectacular finishes, but now the end of his run, obviously he's older now, has not been impressive by any stretch. And he also got popped for steroids or penis pills, if you prefer to believe him and his claims. So to me, right now, you know, August 3rd, 2016, GSP is the greatest fighter ever. Nick Diaz should have no shame in losing to him. I mean, Nick Diaz is whatever 9-10 losses in his career, and it's like he lost to a lot lesser fighters than GSP. To to say this stuff as like an excuse. He doesn't need it. There's no shame in losing to George St. Pierre.
No, that's the Diaz brothers' mindset. That in their mind, they have never lost a fight ever.
True.
And yeah. And I know where they're coming from because I've been that guy. I'm the guy that when I've been competing and whatever, especially there's a subsect of jiu-jitsu players like me, and I always have to remind myself, just shut up and stop being a whiner. But there's a frustration that comes, particularly when you face wrestlers, and you know that you have more technique, more skills, you know more things, but they're just really good at stifling you. And not that George St. Pierre is your typical lay and pray guy, but compared to Nick, he's definitely a lot more lay and pray, and he fights cautiously. And, you know, the Diaz brothers, they go out there and they really do just go to finish. They get right in somebody's face. They say, let's make this a fight. You hit me, I'll hit you back. When they're on the ground, they go for it. So, like, and, you know, every fighter's got their little mental hiccup that helps them get through the losses and all that. And yes, by the way, for the record, George St. Pierre, I always argued he was better than Anderson Silva, and that was before Silva had ever lost. Simply when you look at, you know, Anderson Silva was fighting, you know, Patrick Cote and some, you know, he has a lot of fights there where they sucked and he didn't look all that good in them. Whereas George St. Pierre was taking on guys that if St. Pierre didn't exist, they'd be winning 7 or 8 fights in a row as title fights. So,
yeah. I mean, the other thing with that era too that I still remember vividly is that, granted, GSP didn't have these spectacular finishes, and people remember that, but just like the way in his prime, like, he dominated John Fitch, when John Fitch had gone on a run of 7-0, was like this incredible wrestler, taking everybody down, and Fitch was on a run where he probably hadn't lost a round in, you know, 5, 6, 7 fights. GSP, like, destroyed him on the ground, took him down at will, beat him up. Fitch couldn't get up. Like, that's the fight to me that, like, epitomizes George St. Pierre. He would beat guys at their own game.
That was UFC 87 in Minnesota, Minneapolis. I was there live. I remember watching it. Two things that always, actually, that was also the show where John Jones made his UFC debut. But
Brock fought. Brock was in co-main.
Yeah. He fought Heath Herring, and the things that always, struck out for me from that night were, one, how gigantic Brock Lesnar is in person. Like, three things. Two, how ordinary and regular Kenny Florian looked in person. I remember when he walked by, I went, Kenny Florian's the same size I am. He's not cutting a lot of weight. And then obviously George St. Pierre, I thought it was the most complete performance of his career. I think it's a career highlight for him. John Fitch was amazing, and he just beat the hell out of him everywhere. And you know what? St. Pierre also did have, until the end, when he kind of became this jabbing machine, a little more patient and a little more cautious, George St. Pierre ran through dudes and was finishing, you know, Sean Sherk real quick, Frank Trigg real quick, Matt Hughes got finished all the time, finished BJ Penn. You know, he had his run, he had his finishes there too. And, again, he's somebody that kind of evolved with the sport, and his style evolved as the challengers evolved. And that's it.
All right. We're at about an hour now, so I'm thinking we should finish it up.
Yeah.
A few fights announced this week. So scale of 1 to 10, how interested are you in each of these fights, and tell me why, just quickly. Some of these are in, like, heavy negotiations I've seen, but we're going to say they're signed and a done deal. Fair enough?
No, yeah, I'll go with it.
All right. Rafael Dos Anjos versus Tony Ferguson, 1 to 10.
7.5, 8. I'm a big fan of Tony Ferguson. I love his style. I think he's one of the most entertaining and amazing lightweights out there. The winner of that fight should basically face Alvarez, I think, for the title. And we'll see if Dos Anjos just got caught, or if this new era is affecting him, whatever it may be. Really, anytime for Tony Ferguson fights, I get excited. I don't know if there's a more exciting lightweight time in and time out than Tony Ferguson.
Yeah, he goes in there and bangs. You think, since that fight looks like it's going to be signed, they're going to go with Nurmagomedov versus Alvarez next for the lightweight belt? Or you think they're just going to put Alvarez on ice for 6-8 months?
I think it probably depends on what Alvarez wants. If he needs a little bit of time, otherwise, I think Nurmagomedov is who they'd go with. I don't think it should headline a pay per view ever. Plus, the odds of Nurmagomedov not getting hurt are, you know, not that great. So, I mean, it's lightweight. There's going to be guys. I mean, for all we know, Donald Cerrone will say, I'll drop down and fight at 155 again, and he'll get a title shot. Or maybe, you know what? Maybe after, in a couple of weeks, Nate Diaz, if he beats Conor again, I'd have him face Alvarez instead. I think that would be, that could be a gigantic fight.
Or even if Conor wins. I mean, Conor was going to get that shot at 155. Granted, it's going to piss everybody off that he's not defending the featherweight belt, but, I mean, that was the original plan. People forget that. He was supposed to fight RDA for the title, and obviously the Nate Diaz thing caught fire. Moving along, Jimmy Manua versus OSP. We talked about him last week. You care about that?
Maybe a 2 or a 3, and only because Manua tends to be heavy-handed and OSP is kind of good, but if they never fought again, I wouldn't even notice.
We also have got Brandon Thatch versus Eric Silva.
Oh, that's about, you know, it's a solid 5 or 6. That's do or die for both guys. Should be really good on the feet. But Brandon Thatch has kind of been a disappointment in the UFC. Eric Silva has been a mixed bag, but they're both aggressive strikers, just go out there and throw, and not bad. So yeah, I could say 5 or 6 with the potential for tons and tons of action. It's a fight that when the show comes around that week, I'll look at it and I'll go, I'll watch that. Yeah, that looks good.
And lastly, out of all of these, this is the one I was most looking forward to. Luis Smoka versus Sergio Pettis.
Ooh, that's obviously I always look forward to a Pettis brother fighting. But you know what? You got to give Sergio Pettis so much credit, even outside my own bias. That dude has fought a lot of really good guys at a young age, early in his UFC career. Like, they threw him to the wolves, and he's more or less hung with them. He hasn't, you know, been the super-duper once-in-generation-level fighter, but he has more than proven himself. And Luis Smoka, that ain't no joke. That fight's, that could be something special, and especially Sergio Pettis. Pettis at 25 or 35, you know, either one, I think he eventually grows into being a big 35, if maybe not a small 45 someday, although he's much smaller than his brother. He's got star quality, and he's really damn good. That's a hell of a fight. I'd give that a solid 7.5.
Yeah, no, out of all of those, Smoka looked great in that last fight. Just his ground game was kind of blew me away. I was like, wow, this guy's good. And then Pettis is like super. I think he's super underrated. I mean, he's lost 2 fights in the UFC. He's 5-2 overall. One is to Caceres, and one's to Ryan Benoit. Where his 2 losses, but
In the Caceres fight, he was winning that fight until he got tapped at the very with 30 seconds. And we've seen, and after what I just saw Caceres do to Cole Miller. And that becomes even more impressive how good Sergio Pettis must be.
Right. All right. I think that covers it.
Yeah, that's it. I guess I should get in my Wait, I don't have to do plugs on my show. You will have a column coming out in today when this airs or tomorrow, whichever day I choose to publish things. And it looks pretty good, and you're going to also have a very special crossword puzzle coming out soon, everybody. That's right, crossword puzzles. I'm trying to figure out how to make it work exactly for all of you people, but push comes to shove, you can print things or type it on your PDF. Get it. I'll put a link to Adobe or something. I don't know.
Yeah, nobody has anything better to do.
I don't. I sit at my fucking computer and stare at the screen and follow the adventures of Cub Swanson in Japan as he gets ready to fight in Utah, which is just stupid.
Yeah, I think he, I know you're not into it, but UFC has a Snapchat account. They did a ton of stuff with him. I want to say like back in May, maybe it was a couple months ago, where he toured like all of Southeast Asia with another, I can't think of the fighter.
It's a Japanese, it's a Japanese guy that all he wants to do is have sex with women.
I haven't actually watched that, but it was like a lot of different stuff from, they were all over the place in Southeast Asia. There's a lot of bad stuff on the UFC Snapchat account. I don't know if anybody actually follows that, but Dennis Bermudez has like a cooking show. It is like so painful. Like he tries to be funny and it just doesn't. It's like watching some bad, like Kane and Katie Vick skits. It's painful. It's bad stuff.
I'm glad I don't. I always assume Snapchat was just for people sending dick pics.
Yeah, I think originally it was, but they've expanded. Snapchat's a big deal now.
It's just too many. There's too many things between Periscope and Facebook Live and Instagram and all these things. Like I can barely keep track of this shit, and it's just whatever. Just I'll become old.
What? Yeah, life is tough.
Yeah. Anyways, everybody, thanks for listening to the show. It's good to have somebody actually host it so we get moving along in a smooth and orderly fashion. It doesn't suck. And it's only 10 o'clock for me now, but I go to bed early because I wake up at 5:30. So I have to get this thing, well, not really edited, just converted and uploaded. So that means that we're done. As always, Matt is a god amongst men, and I am the man amongst gods. Hey, that's actually a good sign off. So thanks for everybody for listening to the show, and we will talk to you probably very soon.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all. Bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about.